Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. Today, we're joined by Jennifer Mayer. Jen has a lifetime cash-in of $20 million over her 26 years in the industry. She's the SVP of Strategic Partnerships at Govig & Associates, where she's at the helm of business development, and she leads the overall team of 27 recruiters. She's actively front-facing with clients and plays a significant role in surpassing $14 million in results. Jen's recruitment efforts have been vital in assisting small and medium-sized firms, particularly those under private equity, to double in size. In fact, Jen's placements have contributed to an economic impact exceeding $1 billion. More on that shortly. Jen has consistently been recognized as a top performer throughout her career. She achieved Pacesetter 24 times, was inducted into the MRI Hall of Fame, and is the recipient of the prestigious Alan R. Schoenberg Lifetime Achievement Award. She currently serves as the president of the MRI Network Charitable Foundation. Jen, welcome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks, Mark. Good to see you.
Yeah. So I think we first met at the Pinnacle Society Conference in San Diego. Am I remembering correctly?
Yep. Yeah. A couple of years ago. Yep.
And I think we've met at least once since then, and we've caught up on the phone. Always a pleasure to catch up with you. I am excited about learning from you today. So I know your professional career started with MRI, am I right? How did that come about? How did you get into the business?
Yeah, so I grew up in the business. Actually, my dad was in it, and I was one of those kids that swore I would never get in it. You know, the table talk from a New York Italian was never like, oh, Karen, she's such a great person, pretty colorful, right? So I was like, absolutely not. Graduated from college and, like many, didn't know what I was going to do. And so I was offered an opportunity to go to an MRI office as an intern with the idea that she was going to teach me everything I need to know about sales and go find me a job. And, you know, here we are 27 years later.
Amazing. I love that. We have a mutual friend, Catherine Gerald, who also got started in a family MRI business. And so how old were you when you, so it started as a college intern, is that right? And then you just never left.
Right after I graduated. Yeah. So I was 21. I was in that office for about 6 years. I then opened my own MRI franchise and had that for close to 14. I was then approached by Govig about 8 years ago to fold my business up under theirs and come and replace at the time a woman that was retiring after 32 years with Govig. And stepping into that role for them. And then since then, my role has evolved.
Amazing. So before, I want to talk about what you're doing right now, because you've got a lot of exciting things going on. But just paint a picture for me, your first 6 years in the business in your early 20s, and you're in the top 10% out of 5,000 recruiters at the time. Why do you think you just, you know, went straight to the top there?
I think it was a combination of things. You know, I mean, I seeked out really, really strong mentors at the time, and I didn't try to reinvent the wheel. You know, a lot of people get in the business and you hear a lot of like, well, I don't want to say that, I'm going to sound scripted, or I don't want to do that, or I'm going to do it my way. And I just didn't. I was extremely humble and just said, tell me what you do and I'm going to do it. I worked a lot of hours, obviously, in the beginning. And then that, you know, I was able to taper that off. And I think the turning point for me, because for the first 8 months, I didn't make a placement. So it wasn't like I came out of the gate and I was just killing it, right? And that was no placement in 96 when the market was, I mean, you could fog a mirror and do well in this business, right? So I did not have that. But I think at the end of the day, it was like as soon as I became myself and just got somebody to laugh, I was good. And so I just stopped trying to be somebody else while saying what they say, and just the authenticity and the, you know, just being genuine with people and truly caring about whether or not it's the right move for them was really the turning point for me, for sure.
Okay. Really interesting. So could you elaborate a little more? I didn't know that you first eight months you didn't make a placement. And just in case there's anyone listening who really needs to hear this story, because maybe they're in a slump, or maybe they're, whether they're just getting started, or maybe they have performed well in the past, but they're in a slump. Can you elaborate a little more detail about like being more authentic, being yourself? What difference that made to turn things around for you?
I think I just stopped selling. You know, I mean, we go in and we, you know, make a cold call and we automatically just vomit all over the place about how, you know, where we come from or what, how we're good or how we specialize in whatever industry. And we just vomit all over people. And it's just, it's very self-serving. You know, the minute they say, oh, we don't have a need or we don't use recruiters, we're just like, okay, bye, you know, and we just move on. And I think that people catch on to that. And I think, you know, they're smart to it, that if that person's not going to push a little bit to understand that individual at that point, then it's absolutely self-serving. And so I just think that I was able to master, and I, you know, I could probably dig deep and figure out how I did it, but I was able to master the idea of, like, at the end of the day, it really was about me. I mean, I was not doing this to be a social worker. I was doing it to make money, but they didn't catch on to that. And so, you know, I just stopped talking. I just started asking questions and really just trying to engage them in a conversation that went beyond the idea of, like, do you need my candidate or can I help you fill a role? It didn't become about I wasn't human trafficking at that time. I wasn't selling people. I was really just going into figuring out, like, can we work today? Can we work later? Can we never work together? And going from there.
Okay, fantastic. That makes a lot of sense, to talk less and listen more, ask really good questions, and that opens up opportunities for sure. So then you launched your own MRI franchise, and you had that for 14 years and did really well there. You're in the top 50 out of 750 offices worldwide. What made you decide to then join forces with Govig? And because, you know, going from being, you know, your own boss to then obviously you're still in a leadership role and have a significant impact, but you're needing to collaborate with others at in the management team.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I think it comes down to being really real with yourself as to where your strengths are and what you love to do. And mind you, I was a totally recruited candidate. In fact, Todd hired a recruiter to find this role, who was my old boss, you know, however many years ago. He's the one that got me into the business. And I knew Todd. I mean, we traveled in the same circles, and he just would have never thought to reach out to me because I was doing well. And so for the first four conversations, it was like, I'm not interested. And then he totally hooked me by, you know, come out to Phoenix and just see it and whatever, you know, and then the rest was history. But I think when I really dialed it down, I hated the administrative side of owning my business. I hated it. I mean, the idea of sitting with bankers and looking over contracts and lawyers and accountants and paying bills and feeling the personal responsibility of these families of people that worked for me was really overwhelming. And I had my own family to worry about, you know? And so I just felt like if I could be in a role where I could grow and expand and not take the risk of my own money, you know, because of my own family and spend somebody else's for that matter. And I could spread my wings, but in a space and a lane that I do best in, which is outward facing or training and developing internally, but not have to worry about any of the administrative stuff of, like, how am I going to keep the lights on? I was going to be in my lane. And that's when I was going to soar and enjoy it. And that really was it. I mean, it wasn't the idea that I felt I couldn't do it on my own, because I was. I just hated that administrative side. Hated it.
It's so interesting because I think that's absolutely true. When you're running your own business, you have to do a little bit of everything. And a lot of those things are not your strength. And maybe you can do them because you have to, but you wouldn't, in an ideal world, be spending your time doing those things, right? And then, so that's a huge factor. So if you've been able to land at a role where you get to do the bits that you like best and that you're best at, then that's awesome. And then also what you said about when it is your business, you kind of never can switch off, right? You're always thinking about it, worrying about it. And yeah, that's definitely, that's got some major drawbacks. So talk to me about, because you are now running a team, but also leading the business development effort. And I think you've got a strength where a lot of other recruiters have a development need. But what I mean by that is probably the number one thing that people come to our coaching firm looking for help with is client development. And especially in the market as it is right now. And it sounds like that's kind of like your forte. Could you talk a little bit about figuring out your how to differentiate yourself and set, like, cut through the noise and set yourself apart from the competition?
Yeah, of course. So I stepped into this role just last January. So this is a very new evolution for me. And it's a new role for Govig. You know, when I came in 8 years ago, and over the time we've really realized, and this probably is the case for a lot of organizations, small or big, where you have kind of the main rainmakers, and then you have the people that are under them filling those roles. And in smaller offices, that rainmaker is typically the owner. I mean, quite frankly, in our office, we had 6 people in our office that drove 80% of the revenue of our company, whether they were recruiting on it themselves or they were driving that business to other recruiters. And that is a very vulnerable state. And, you know, you bring somebody else's eyes to it. And I came in and I was really nervous about that, because these people had been with the company and still are here, but have been with the company over 20 years, some 25. They're going to age out. You know what I mean? I mean, even me, I'm at a point where I'm going to age out.
No way. You're years away from that.
I know. When I'm 21, of course. So I just got super nervous about that. And so from the very get-go, my initiative was to teach and drive business development, even when people were on a fulfillment side. What could they be doing, and what conversations, and what should they be listening for in order to flip those calls and either bubble those leads up to somebody else or handle it themselves? And so one of those factors was I learned very early on in my career this concept of pattern interrupt. And I learned it. I don't know if it was, you know, started here, but I learned it from an individual who was a military interrogator. And, you know, he taught me this, and it was a huge change again in my communication style, because it was the idea that people get trained to answer something based on what they're used to, or how they've been trained to do that. So like an example would be, you know, you walk into a store and the salesperson comes up and says, can I help you? And you go, no, I'm just looking. Even when you're there to find something, right? Or you hear a pause when you answer the phone and you just automatically know it's a telemarketer and you put your back up against the wall. And so I started to think about things that we could do that just from the get-go, people don't pick up the phone and assume that we're going to ask them for money or it's going to cost them something on the business development side. So as simple as when you call somebody that doesn't know you and you start by, you know, this is Jen Meyer, I'm the SVP with Govig and Associates, how are you? They automatically know this is a salesperson. And so it was trying to think of things that I could say that bridged that. So for, you know, at first when I lived in Cleveland, it was easier than Scottsdale, but I would say, you know, this is Jen Meyer, I'm whoever, you know, I'm out of Cleveland, Ohio. I know you're jealous, aren't you? And I would just pause and they would all laugh, right? Like, you know, because who would
even
be jealous?
I'm not, I know the joke and I'm not from the States, but I can imagine. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not like, you know, the most attractive place. I don't want to offend anybody from Cleveland, but the weather stinks, you know? So it just, and then they would laugh and then I would just move on, right? Or saying to somebody, instead of saying, do you have a few minutes, saying, are you in a place you can talk confidentially? Or I now say, and what I teach my recruiters here to say, but I've had to tell my IT people, it's a strategy that this isn't really happening. When I get somebody on the phone, I'll say who I am. And then I'll say, can you hear me okay? And they'll go, yeah. And I'm like, okay, great. I've just been having some headset problems anyway. And I just move on. And I just don't do the things that typical salespeople would do, which then bleeds to recruiters. That then evolves to things like when you think about it, you know, you said we had this mutual contact. I do think that all roads lead to somebody that either worked for MRI, was trained by MRI, you know, all of that training of the recruiters that are out there all came from the same place. It all stemmed from the same place. And so we're all saying the same thing. whether you're 30 minutes into the business or you're 30 years into the business, like everybody is saying the same thing and overcoming objections in the same way. So what can you do that just sounds different? You know what I mean? And I think if you think about it from a perspective of what is that person going to hear based on their world helps you. You know, one of the things that I talk a lot about is our fee, right? Like we're one of the most expensive firms out there. We charge a third and we get pushback all the time because there are a lot of recruiters out there, not knocking because it works for them, but that do 15, 20% contingency. And we're just not that. You know, we know our lane and we're not that, but we're up against it. And so I said to my recruiters, I said, think about it this way, any industry that you're in, if you're talking to somebody that their world is that they sell on price and they have the low, you know, they sell and they win by saying we're the cheapest, you're not going to bring them up because they see no value in that. But if you're up against somebody that's a midpoint point price or they're the most expensive and they're selling on value, then you're able to turn it to, well, you're the most expensive and why, you know? You know, and it could be manufacturing, it could be healthcare, it could be anything of bringing it to their world of why do they charge what they charge and how do they sell what they sell? It's based on the service and product that they're offering, and we're doing the same. And so if you speak to them in their language, they get it. They get why.
I love that. Speak to them in their language. That's a golden nugget right there. Because for sure, if you can relate it to their own industry, and their position in their industry, they're not the cheapest, you know, we're the same, then all of a sudden they get it and it, you know, makes total sense. I love your idea of pattern interrupts as well. And the one of, you know, walking into a retail store is classic, right? Because everyone can identify with that. There's a patterned, you know, question, can I help you? And then the response is, no, thanks, I'm just looking, right? And we need to break out of that. Let me run one past you that I like is, instead of, you know, the example you gave, which is what 99% of people do. Hi, this is Mark Whitby from Recruitment Coach. How are you today? Right? Right away, you know, it's a sales call. Whereas for various reasons, one of which is tonality is wrong. And number two is like asking how you are, although it seems polite and professional, is actually in most cases not going to advance the conversation. Instead of, or the other alternative you gave was, you know, is this a good time to talk? Or have you got a few minutes? The answer is almost always going to be no to that question, right? So here's a pattern interrupt that I like. Instead of saying, have you got a minute to talk, to say, I've only got a minute, right? And just that subtle change and it makes it like you're the busy one and you're just between meetings and you, but you, it was, it implies so much just with a few words, right? It implies, you're busy. It implies you're not going to take up their time, but without sounding like you're begging for their time, right? And also, they've probably not heard that before, so it interrupts the pattern, and now it's they're curious about, oh, what? I wonder why he's calling me in between meetings. So,
I love that. I love that. You're exactly right.
I know that words matter to you, and the way that you position things, and you're just on another level with this. Do you have any other examples of how you play with words in order to have a greater impact and differentiate yourself?
So I was literally just talking to some of my recruiters about this yesterday. One of the things I love about our business in relation to the first dialogue is that it's by the phone. And to me, that neutralizes things. And so I can do things and have body language that I wouldn't normally have in a face-to-face meeting. But I said to them, like, I do start a lot of questions. First of all, when I'm in a conversation, of course you're smiling and you're happy, but there is a tonality, as you mentioned, that hits people. And so when I'm in a conversation with somebody, I take the aggression off. And listen, I am like uber dysfunctionally competitive, and I grew up in a New York Italian family, so I can be pretty aggressive and direct. So I've had to learn that I slow down and I move my octaves in my voice down. So I'm slow and low when I'm trying to dig deeper, or I'm talking about if I'm up against the wall on a negotiation, I'm low and slow. So my my feelings or my energy or just neutral. And so, and then I'll start a lot of my questions by, you know, Mark, I'm just curious. Like, or, you know, I was thinking, what do you think about this? Or, you know, I have a question for you. You know, it just, it's the tone of like, just a, I told him, I like, it's almost like the shrugging emoji on the other end of the phone. You're like, I'm just curious. Like, if you have to do that to like change the tonality, do it. They can't see you. Right. So it's just this like shrug and, you know, like, and it's not this, again, it goes back to your almost answering the question, or it sounds like you're asking the question in a way that is truly curious, that you're just digging a little bit deeper just because you genuinely want to know. It doesn't sound like you're filling out a form or you're checking the boxes or you're doing it from a self-serving standpoint. And those things have shifted their back. The other thing that I'll do, MPC marketing is big, especially for newer recruiters. I still believe heavily in it, in the sense that, and I don't know if other people call it MPC or impact player marketing or whatever they call it, right? I do think that it's a great point of entry for a lot of people because you have something in hand. I struggled with it because I never felt that I knew that person, and I felt it was extremely presumptuous to say, I've got the perfect person for you. And so even from the beginning, I struggled with that concept. And so I just developed this verbiage around, hey, listen, Mark, you and I have never spoken before, so I don't know if this person would be right for your team or right for your organization. What I do know is, based on the people that I talk to in the marketplace, they're excited about this person, and I believe this person is amazing. But I'd like to take a couple minutes with you, tell you a little bit about their background, see if it makes sense to make the introduction. And if not, that's okay too. You know, and just, I'm just very soft about it, you know? And then either way, whether they say they are wanting to, you know, and I tell them, like, I give them maybe one or two nuggets, and then I'll say, you know, I know that's not a lot to go off of, but just based on that, do you think that this is somebody that could bring value to your team? And then we just go from there. Or I may say, do you feel like it's somebody that you'd want to learn more about? And either whether the question or I'm sorry, answer is yes or no, the follow-up is why. It's just such an easy conversation, and you're selling, but you're not shoving that person down the person's throat before you're taking the opportunity to understand, is this person right for them? Or are you just trying to get that person set up on a send out because of your own metrics? And people feel it. You know, people feel it.
I love that script. Thanks for sharing, Jen. That's really powerful. And it's funny because last week I interviewed a guy called Brent Orsuga, and he was saying something similar, which is that, why do recruiters always say, I've got the perfect candidate, or this job is amazing? They use these generalizations, which nobody believes when you say that, right? Because how could you say they're perfect when you really don't know that much about my business yet? You know, it's a presumption that it just doesn't land, I think. And the way you position that was so much more elegant. And it now helps me understand what you said earlier, when things started really taking off for you, was when you stopped pushing and selling and like putting your agenda on somebody. And when you talk about getting curious and being more like being genuinely curious, you're going to get a whole lot more out of that conversation, right? And so the way you did that, the other thing I liked was, I think in sales, especially, well, in sales in general, and particularly in business development, it's so, of course, we want to win and we want to get the deal and we want to win the client. On one level, you're going to try your hardest, but on another level, you need to detach from the outcome. Right. And because otherwise that desperation is, and that kind of your need is going to come across. And whereas if you detach from the outcome and make it so that, like, really, you don't care if they say yes or no. And actually, they, not that you would say this because it sounds rude, but you're thinking to yourself, they need me more than I need them. Right. And the way you gave that script and you said, like, I can't remember the exact verbiage you used, but it was along the lines of, you know, to explore whether this person could add value to your team. And if not, that's okay too, right? It's like making either of those outcomes perfectly fine. And it it lets them relax because they know you're not going to try and force this candidate down their throat, right? So then they might let their guard down a little bit and let you actually have a meaningful conversation. That's really smart.
And I just want to build on something with that too, is like that, you know, when we're in the game, we're always thinking about, to your point, the outcome. I mean, that was dead on. Like, we're always thinking, let's make the placement. We forget that the steps that need to get there. So it's even like when you're prepping a candidate and a candidate has a first interview, the first thing you're going to say to them is, look, they're not going to make you an offer on the spot. So you don't need to oversell yourself to get the job. You need to say enough and intrigue them enough to move to the next step. You know, so it allows them to just not push their agenda down somebody's throat. We're in the same boat. I mean, first step is just either having another conversation or setting up an interview, but you're not going to make a placement on that call. Or people think about when they're recruiting, oh my God, I got to make the placement. And they think the placement is the best day of their lives. When reality, the best day of their lives was when they got the search assignment or they found the candidate. That was the best days of their lives, right? So it's not putting the cart before the horse and looking too far down the road, but focusing in where are you at now, you know, and what do we need to accomplish now in order to get there?
You alluded to something earlier, but then we quickly moved past it. And I wanted to circle back. You mentioned that one of the areas you've been focusing on within GoVig and Associates has been helping the team members on the fulfillment side to be more proactively involved in the business development effort. Could you elaborate? You said, like, what should they be listening for? How could they flip the call? And what leads should they bubble up to the business development person? But could you elaborate on those points?
Yeah, and I will tell you, this is probably one of the most challenging things to train people on or to get people to do, because everybody's very tunnel visioned into I need to find the candidate, right? And so there's a lot of things that are being said in that conversation that are just flying right by somebody. So for example, for me, when people say that they are open to exploring opportunities because a company is downsizing, you know, they're nervous, they made it through the cut, but they don't know where it's going to go. That to me sends opportunity, because that's a top grading opportunity for me with that hiring manager, meaning that if you're downsizing, you now expect and need somebody to do more or have a different skill than they did when you hired them. And they may not have that. So do you need to replace that person, which you're only going to do confidentially, which is where we come into play, right? So when I hear that, I'm marking that down that I need to call that manager because that person may be thinking that same thing. A lot of recruiters don't think that way. The other thing is when you're talking to candidates and you're saying, you know, who do you report to? How many members are on your team? And they're giving you the facts about what's happening. A lot of times you're going to hear like, well, we used to have 5, but now we have 4. Well, there may be an opening there. My boss quit and now I have a new boss. Well, where did that person come from? There may be an opening there. Like, you know, it just, somebody made a move, their boss moved to a new company. Where did they go? And then that person may be building their own team, right? So there's all of these ways. I mean, I think we were taught that, like, when you, I don't even know if people name gather anymore, but when they go in and they ask for somebody and they go, oh, they're no longer here, they just kind of move on, right? And we were kind of taught, well, that may mean that there's an opening there, but it goes so deeper than that, you know, in the conversations that you're having. And you're having those conversations with candidates as if you're getting to know those candidates, but you're just hearing things that are happening around them that could be business opportunities for you.
This is brilliant, Jen. Absolutely. It's the word you used was like listening for opportunities. One of my mentors is a guy called Mike Walmsley, who's like one of the leading trainers in the UK. He was a million pound biller himself and just really, really good guy. He calls this TSI, targeted sales information. So the idea is that, you know, and even in fact, you know, he would give his team members, because he ran a business with about 100 recruiters at one point. All of his recruiters had almost a checklist in front of them. When they were interviewing a candidate, they had to hit these points because they would all potentially lead to either referrals to other candidates or leads to jobs, right? And they were the exact things that you're saying, like, how big's the team there? Who do you report to? You know, et cetera. And listening for not just the answer, but what it implies, what's not said, right? And the suggested opportunities there. So are there any other things that you want your delivery people to be hyper aware of so that you guys pick up on all those opportunities?
I just think that, you know, again, taking the conversation a little bit beyond the surface level of what they do and what they, you know, want to do, but it's what environment do they work best in? Like, learn about these cultures of these companies, learn about what they're seeing in the marketplace. Are there new companies popping up? Where are they in relation to their competition? Why? You know, and because you'll learn like where you should be maneuvering in the business. And don't be afraid. People take that person's word for the Bible. And I always found like, I have to know this myself, right? So I was just never afraid to call those people. They never knew where I got their name from. But I would just pick up the phone and or reach out to them and just talk to them, because at the end of the day, like, nobody knows what's truly going on in somebody's mind until you have that conversation directly. You know, it's so I just wouldn't, you know, dig around for yourself. Don't just take what they're saying for their own opinion about it.
This is really interesting. And I'm curious, I'm using your technique now. I'm curious, Jen, like, getting people to actually do this, when you say that it's not that they don't want to do it or they don't understand the concept, right? But they have tunnel vision. Their main KPI is, I need to find candidates for this opening within this time frame, right? And so that's what they're kind of focused on. And what you're asking for them is to, like, almost think in this fractal pattern where they're thinking about all these other things. Do you incentivize people to do that? Like, do they get a bonus, or how do you track these leads and kind of hold people accountable to it? Because I feel like when you run the workshop and you do the, and they're like, oh yeah, I'm going to do that, that's a great idea. And then it, you know, they do it for a bit, but then it kind of falls off again. How do you kind of drive that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great point. And I do think that, you know, as an individual contributor and as a manager, you have to inspect what you expect, right? And we're never really great at that. It's been easier. We did make the transition to Crelate a few years ago, and they do have a great lead generation portal, if you will, like, segment of their software package. And it does help. And we do have that a part of our recruiters' KPIs. So even if you're not targeted as a business development recruiter in our office, some of your KPIs is lead generation. And so you can put those leads into Crelate. So it is marked that it was your lead. And so we follow that, you know, and we try, we incentivize. So we're getting better, but each of our business units really does have their own split rules. We are working on getting that unified throughout the organization. So, but there is one of our division that I used to run, and came in with, I did incentivize. So I did give a 10% lead generation piece of the business. So like 40% was the contract and 10% was the lead. So if you got the search and you developed the contract, but that lead came from another recruiter, you got your 40%, but the recruiter got 10. If you did both, you got your 50%. You know what I mean? So I did carve that out, so that it did incentivize these recruiters that, look, you have skin in the game to do it, you know? So, and then on top of that, like, I talked a lot with them about metrics of, you know, I think we've talked to less than 1% of people that we leave voicemails for or reach out to from a business development standpoint. That jumps to like almost 20% on the recruiting side, or even higher on the reference check side. So it's like, why on earth would you bang your head up against the wall with a probability of less than 1% in one area when you have the person on the phone already and you can go there, you know? And so I talk a lot about that. And I think that when they realize, like, oh my gosh, I made 100 marketing calls and I talked to one person versus I made 50 recruiting calls and I talked to 20 people, you know, they realize, okay, wait, I mean, that's just stuck on stupid if you're like trying to do it a different way when the results can already be there.
100%. Jen, what's your, I've heard so many different takes on this, and I'd love to hear the Jen Mayer philosophy on flipping candidates, because like it has to be done in an elegant way where it feels natural, and otherwise it's not going to work, right? So what is your, and so some people are like, you know, oh, well, it's a separate call because it would be too obvious or too awkward if I try and ask them about their own team growth when I'm recruiting them. And then other people are like, no, you just, you know, you switch gears. You say, hey, before I go, let me ask you a different question or whatever. What's your approach to this?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, where they're savvy to it. That's the whole pattern interrupt thing, right? Like, people are super savvy compared to what they were 30 years ago. And again, they're hearing the same thing. I mean, no recruiter, well, any good recruiter is going to get off the phone and say, hey, I have one last question. I wouldn't be doing my job if I didn't ask, blah, 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 right? And I think the biggest thing too is people won't do it, especially if they're talking to an individual contributor versus a manager. If they're not in a hiring manager role, why would you flip it? Because they're always like, I have no idea, right? So those areas that I was talking about in regards to, you can ask those questions even if you're not doing a full interview with them to know if they would be right for your role. Because the reality is, if they say no to that position, you should be shifting to a point of, okay, is it a no because you're just not ever going to be interested? Or is it that this particular thing isn't right for you? And let's talk about that, right? So you're still shifting the conversation to understand those things and can be asking those questions. When I'm dealing with a hiring manager, the way I go with it is that, and this is especially if you now have them in the process, because then you're still continuing to build rapport. And people think, well, if I had somebody in the process, why would I recruit for their company? And I go down a path of how you leave an organization is going to be the mark and what they remember. That's your legacy. So, you know, you could be the best person and have made the biggest impact on an organization, but if you leave in a negative way, that's what they remember. They don't go, oh, Mark was amazing here, even though he left on bad terms or whatever it is, right? So with executives or individual contributors, I go down a path of like, how you leave that organization is going to be your legacy. And nobody wants to leave their company worse than when they came in. So it really is your responsibility to make sure that they're in good hands, even if you're leaving because you don't believe in the culture. Because there are no bad people or bad cultures, they're just bad fits. So there is somebody out there that could fit into that culture, even if you don't. And so I just go down this path of, what can I do to help you leave your legacy, leave your mark in a good place? Is it that we need to find your backfill? Is it that we need to build your team to a place where they are in a good standing so that you can leave and know that you didn't leave that person with a cleanup or a mess? You know, just all those things. So I take it to more of an emotional, like, how do I help you look good? And how I make you look good is you leaving on good terms, no matter what, you know? And that seems to resonate really well with especially, you know, VPs and C-suite type of people.
That is awesome. I have never heard that approach before, Jen. I think that's, and I've been doing this a long time, almost as long as you. And yeah, that is an original, fantastic idea. Tell me, well, while we're talking about original thing, I like the way you think. And I teased in the introduction that you've had an economic impact exceeding $1 billion. I'm interested to know how you arrived at that figure, but conceptually, I love this concept, right? Because we do make an impact in this industry. You know, it's hard, even if you don't quantify it, you're changing the life of the person you placed in terms of progressing their career. That has an impact on their own immediate family, potentially their whole community. Obviously, you have an impact on the company because you're introducing a change agent, someone who's going to drive results, make them more competitive, more profitable, et cetera. So you're having a positive impact on the company and all the people who rely on them, whether that's their customers, their shareholders, their other employees. And so I totally get this concept. How did you quantify the impact that you're making?
You know, the thought process behind it was that I think the industry that we are closest to in relation to, like, you know, we have to sell on both sides is real estate, right? you know, real estate agents deal with the whole idea that, you know, your house is only worth what people are going to pay for it. It's not what you want to sell it for, kind of thing. And they're selling on buyers and sellers. And so when you look at that industry, when you see, oh, that's a $1 million producer in that industry, that $1 million isn't based on what they commissioned. It's based on the sale price of the house. Well, we're the same. We always talk about the size of our billings or our business in relation to what we're invoicing it, or what our split was in relation to cash in. But we really should be talking about the salaries of the people that we place, you know, if you were going to relate it that way. So we started to make that shift of like, in any world, if you're a $1 million company, a $500,000 company, I mean, $1 million producer in the recruiting world is a significant producer, right? So, but if you're talking to somebody and you're like, yeah, I bill $1 million or we're a $1 million company or even a $2 million company, and you're talking to companies that are 30, 40, 100, $500 million, you're small on that scale, but we're big in our space. And so what we started to do is we started to calculate it at the point of salaries. What were the salaries of individuals that we placed in a marketplace? So at a very simple level, if you didn't want to go through the whole, you know, formula of how you figure it out to the very penny, at the very least, count it on the salaries that, of the people that you placed. That number is still going to be much greater than what your commission rate is. So at the very least, do that. It does go beyond that, though, where you are at the, you know, again, at the basic level, you are affecting the person and you're affecting the hire manager. So that could be a times two, right? If you wanted to get even granular, I mean, you could certainly go, well, the average size of American households is 3.5 and the, you know, the average size of employees within an organization they're impacting. I mean, you could get pretty granular. The only thing I would say is however you calculate it that same all the time. You know what I mean? Just stay consistent with that calculation. But to keep it easy and easy math, I would either just go the salaries of the people that you placed and packages, not base salaries, but what was the package of the person that you placed? And then you could times it by two in relation to the candidate and the hiring manager directly. That's a direct impact.
That makes total sense. I think there's an argument of even expanding that further in the sense that now some jobs are harder to quantify the economic impact, right? Like if you're placing an engineer, chances are they don't even know what their company is obviously deriving a financial benefit from the work that they right. do, but they have no idea what it is and probably the company doesn't know what it is. But in other roles, they are responsible for X amount, like whether it's a client development or sales role or whether it's an executive position, chances are they do know, like they're there to drive growth from this to this, right? And correct. So in that context, you could, I mean, it would be a bit laborious, but you could average it out and say like the people I place tend to grow their firm by whatever, $10 million. So if I place 10 people, then I'm generating $100 million in impact or whatever, right? But
yeah. At GoBig, we keep it simple just because we're so big. So we do calculate it on just salaries because it's just easier. When I had my own company, you know, I wasn't making 300 placements a year. So it was easier to quantify. And so I used to keep a spreadsheet that my office manager used to fill out that every time we made a placement, she would fill out, you know, based on that person's role, what was the compensation package and multiply it by what was that person overseeing and responsible for. So at the very least, if I knew that that person was managing a team of 14, well, they've now impacted 14 people within that organization directly, right? If they were a CEO and that company was a 300 person company, well, then it's 300 people that they're impacting on a, you know, at a level. So we did have a spreadsheet that we got a lot more specific. It was a very, you know, a lot more of a specific number. But again, to ask, you know, 30 recruiters, and we used to have 50 recruiters, to do that, it's not going to happen. So we just kept it simple. Like, just put their package in the system and we'll go from there, kind of thing.
Yeah, no, that makes total sense. So if you're basing on the salary and if you bill, you know, just to keep the numbers easy, if you bill $1 million and your average fee is 20%, I know yours is higher than that, but let's say an average recruiter, that means that your actual impact in terms of salary was 5 million, right? So
exactly.
Then multiply that yep. by the number of years you've been doing this or what have you, and you've got a number.
That number grows very rapidly when you do it that way.
Absolutely. Now, so here's a takeaway for all of our listeners is, if you've never thought this way before, as of now, start really trying to calculate your individual impact that you're having in the world, and particularly the positive impact you're having for your clients, and trying to quantify that. And if you have the appetite, even go back in history and try and work it out. But even just starting right now, try and figure out what difference are you making? Because I think that's really cool. Like, that motivates me. I mean, we all are money motivated, right? And that's important. But I think the people who have longevity in this business, there's a why that's driving them beyond just the paycheck, right? And it has to mean something. Otherwise, like, this is a tough gig. And, you know, it takes either a special or, you might say, a strange sort of person who's willing to, you know, keep doing this day after day, year after year. But I think that, to me, that would fuel me if I knew that was my reason why, is because I am making that difference.
And I do think we did, you know, because we did have to retro it back like 45 years, right? So that was a big number, right? And that's exactly how we did it, Mark, is we just looked at what our history of billings was, and then we did a multiplier by what our average fee has always been, right? So we went low, we went to 25, just because at some point it probably was 20, you know? So we just averaged it out. And that's how we kind of came up with the number of what our impact is to date from a cumulative perspective. So I would, to your point, I would retro it back, but there's very easy math that you could do that doesn't get too difficult.
How do you use that? Like, do you bring that up in conversations with clients, or like, what's the context for, apart from it, it's kind of cool to think about, but how do you actually apply that?
Yeah, I use it a lot from a marketing perspective, and I'm trying to get my team, obviously, to do it as well. It's a lot easier with newer people than trying to, you know, change the, it's like turning the Titanic with our tenured people, but that's fine. But I just use it as, I mean, I say it instead of like, we're a, you know, $14 million company. I'll just say, you know, my organization has been around for 45 years and we've made an economic impact of this in this marketplace. I use the overall organization because it's just a bigger number. But at the very least, I could say, you know, each division could have its own number if we wanted to get, you know, not too robust where people didn't think it was true. And people always want, you know, they hear economic impact. I've never been questioned by anybody in 20 years of doing this where somebody said, what does that mean? They've never questioned me. You know, the only people that question me are recruiters because they're not used to doing it, you know, but the people that are in the marketplace, they don't even know that there's a difference between size of company and economic impact, right? Like, they just don't even hear it. They probably just hear the number because they're not listening to everything you say. So I wouldn't read too much into it. And it's really boded well for me because I've been able to land, like, I've been in big conversations with big companies up against the Shreks. And you know, we're a little company in Scottsdale, Arizona. We're a big boutique for the executive search, but I'm certainly not going to be up against these large organizations that are, and even a Korn Ferry, they're huge, right? We're not even a speck on the map when it comes to them. But I will tell you, I am up against them a lot and we beat them.
What do you think has been, in addition to everything you've already shared, what do you think has been the key to winning against the big boys there?
So part of that is that those people, and again, it's no knock on them. I mean, you can't look at that organization and think they're terrible, right? Just stylistically, I don't go in and, again, oversell. I do a lot of face-to-face meetings with my clients, even on Teams, and I don't do this big PowerPoint presentation and all of these things. I posture myself, as you alluded to early on in the conversation, I posture myself in a way that, look, I don't need your business. And at the end of the day, if we walk away and you still have this problem, that's not my monkey. That's your monkey, right? Like, I can sleep at night because I don't have to solve that problem. Again, I don't say that, but that's what's going on in the back of my mind. So just posturing wise, it's more about like, look, I'm really here to learn more about your organization and about the problem that you're trying to solve. And if I can be a good resource for you, great. And if I can't, I'll just try to guide you in the right direction. Because I want to make sure this is smart, good business for me as well, you know? And I'm not going to take on something that I really don't think I can fill. And so I do have a little bit of a casualness to me that I don't know if a lot of other people have, but it's just it goes back to what you said, like my time's valuable too, you know? And I'd rather have no business than bad business and get sucked into that stuff. So I think just the posturing of, I don't know if I want your business. I'm not going to oversell and tell you I can solve your problem if I really know I can't. And then I have a flexibility to my style. So, you know, we do the whole weekly huddles and we're very metrics oriented and we do the same things that the big guys do, but I'm also flexible in understanding what are they used to and what do they need in order to make the best conscious decision. And I guarantee you those big guys are not doing that. You know, they're just not. And so the feeling that they get walking away is not just about like you knowing knowing how to do this, but it's that I like working with you. You know what I mean? Like you're an extension of us.
Yeah, absolutely. That all makes sense. And I think I like your, by the way, I liked your choice of words in the way you express things. So the idea of posture, you don't hear that a lot, but it's an interesting way of thinking about how you're approaching a conversation. If think of your posture relative to the other party. And so I think that's a neat way of explaining it. The other thing of like deciding together if it makes sense, if we're going to be a good fit as partners here, rather than I'm pitching and I really want your business and you're going to get this full pitch. And in fact, one of my clients had a nice phrase that I liked, which is she would say, if we decide to take this search, right? So it's almost shifting the power dynamic, right? By saying, if we decided to take the search, here's how we would approach it. And here's what we would need from you in order to make this partnership successful, right? And so rather than like, please, please, please give me this business. So Jen, I'm really interested to learn more about, I know you're mentoring and you're training and developing people. And I know that's something that you enjoy and you're passionate about. So thinking for our listeners who are managers or owners, could you give us a few of your most effective methods of helping your team members to be successful?
Listen, a billing manager role is probably the hardest role in this business, right? Because you know that whatever you bill is going to the bottom line of the organization. It's the most profitable, you know, structure, but it's the hardest job. I really did make it a point where I carved out at least 2 times a week. It was on my schedule, blocked as if it was a client meeting or it wouldn't happen. I do think we've lost desk side training where people are sitting and listening to their calls, barging in on their calls. And if you don't have the capability of doing that on your phone system, get it. It's invaluable. Where you can give them real time feedback. Because I guarantee if you sit down and you say, and we would do the same, it's no, you know, I probably did it too, where you say, well, I said this, and then they said this, and then I said this. No, you didn't, right? Like, and you didn't say it like that, right? So being able to really listen, and if it's not that you can barge in, doing live call reviews, where you're getting them to listen to their own call, and then asking them first, okay, now that you've heard that back, like, what do you think? You know, and 9 times out of 10, they're going to tell you what they did wrong. So then it's not criticism because they came up with it. You know what I mean? Like, what did you think you missed over that? Or now hearing it, like, how would you say it differently? You know, so I think that we push ourselves onto them and people's just natural reaction is to get defensive. So if you're able to kind of change your style to getting them to a place where they recognize it themselves, it's super, super effective. And so I always did that. And when I got away from it, I was never inspecting what I expected. And I'm going to tell you that it hurt my team. It hurt the development and it hurt my team. And so I still sit in the middle of the bullpen. Maybe I'm old fashioned We have a hybrid model. When I'm recruiting or I'm business developing, I'm right in the center of a team so they can hear me too. And then just, again, just being desk side, checking their plan. Like, it's not about a list, but who are you really planning on calling and what time are you going to call them and why are you going to call them that? Because I look back, I mean, that DISC profile, I mean, any personality profile you give me, whatever it is in regards to conformity, my doesn't even show up as a color on the line, right? Like, I am like, on a scale from 1 to 100, I'm probably a negative 50. And so it took a lot of discipline for me business-wise to be a structured person and to follow some level of structure, because I'm not that way on a personal level. Like, I'm super spontaneous. I never have a plan. My kids go crazy. So you have to push people to do that, because it's not the people that we're hiring. It is not a natural, they're not wired that way. And so it is your responsibility to make sure that they're following that and they're developing that muscle to flex, you know, because it will help them down the road.
I agree 100%. I like that you're checking people's plans and also the providing real feedback on live calls. We tell all our clients, we've got most of them doing it now, to record all of their calls, client calls, candidate calls, wherever, as much as possible, get those recorded, even get them transcribed. There's a lot you can do with AI that we don't have time to go into today. But recording those calls is so valuable because you're going to get two things. You're going to get an opportunity for people to listen back. And as a coach, you just ask them the right questions for them to realize what they can improve on to just keep getting better and better. You're also going to get some examples of really outstanding and effective calls, or even segments of calls, snippets from calls, right? And you build up this library of like, the greatest hit, like these are the best practices. These are like, memorize these because they work. And you can shorten people's like learning curve dramatically that way, because especially in a remote environment, they are not hearing you on the phone, right? So that's a way of replicating. I mean, you can buddy up and do like sort of remote bullpen, but it's probably easier just to record the calls and then listen back. Jen, one more thing I wanted to ask you about is balancing, you know, your career ambitions with family and you know, how you've managed to do that. And balance is the wrong word, but being able to get everything you can from all aspects of your life.
Yeah, I got rid of the whole, once I got rid of the idea of that there is never work-life balance. So whoever is striving for that is going to become super disappointed because they're never going to arrive to it. So I like to think of it as work-life harmony. And the reason I say that is that there are times when my family needs me more than the business and I have to be there. And there's times that the business needs me more than my family and I have to be there. And I have to be okay with that. And I just have to be wherever I'm at, I got to be there, right? So, you know, when I opened my own business, and this was not planned, but when I opened my own business, I ended up getting pregnant 6 months after I opened it. Now, I had never really been around babies, so I thought the baby was just going to lay on the floor and we were just going to go on with our merry way. And as you know, that didn't happen. So, I personally probably made some sacrifices that I wasn't around for some things with my kids when they were smaller. And because I chose the business side, but it was more because I needed that financial stability for my family. It wasn't because I emotionally didn't want to be there. And again, that choice was okay for me, you know, but it was okay for me. I can't push that on whatever that is okay for somebody else. And, you know, I think that over time, you know, my youngest probably got the better of it because I was established by that point, and so I could be around more. Now, my oldest is not any less of a person and we don't have any less of a relationship because I chose business in the beginning, you know. So I just had to come up with that right harmony. And there were times, so when my kids were smaller, I did again make the choice that from 4:30 in the afternoon to 7:30, I was offline. I did not look at my phone. I didn't check email. I mean, if you were bleeding or somebody was dying, then you could get a hold of me. But nothing trumped that. And I controlled it and I controlled it well. And we had dinner together and I got them their, you know, bathed, or I got them to have their, you know, good night story. And they had that 3 hours of interrupted attention from me. And that was really, really important. And so I think that 3 hours of uninterrupted attention was probably more impactful than having 8 hours of interrupted attention, you know? So, I mean, that's what worked for me. But again, there were certainly times when I made the conscious decision and sacrifice that I needed to be one place or the other based on what was going on for me at that time. And that was just the way it was and still is.
Yeah, I love that. And do you know, I know this interview is going to be super popular. And the reason is you've given really specific, actionable insights, like everything from having that 4:30 to 7:30 window to achieve life work harmony. Like that's something specific that someone can take away. And the, like the little scripts you've given us and the specific tactical things as well as the strategic things. I really appreciate you. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah, you're welcome. This has been fun.
Awesome. All right. Well, I look forward to catching up with you again on another occasion. Have a great rest of your day.
Thanks, Mark. Take care.